Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Monday night installment here at Your Remedy Is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various offensive litigating strategies. And this is with our speaker, Mr. David Merlin. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy Is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy Is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless. And it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedy Is in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com. If we look in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes all the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known purely for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedy Is in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of YourRemedyIsInTheLaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups that Your Remedy Is in the Law. And Your Remedy Is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at YourRemediesInTheLaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict, pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you'll get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points? What are you interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights. Anything that you can think of that if it affects your personal rights in one way or another, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much like you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal things, their personal things, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be a tremendous amount of help to you. And maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the further you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to a point where you've educated to yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hopefully you'll pass that around. Freedom's Radio. If you're on the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number on the pin. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedom's Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that, honestly, most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. And we make those introductions. Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best. And believe you me, we aim for the best. The unavoidable things do sometimes happen. And when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have had to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you call board and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, thank you for that wonderful disclaimer. I appreciate that very much. Ladies and gentlemen, I have some housekeeping to do, and then I'd also encourage you, if you're first-time callers here, to grab a pen and paper, something to take a note on. I'm going to be giving out some contact information, some websites that you may be interested in since you're on this call. The first is someone from Jacksonville, Florida, a phone number ending in 0884. How did you hear about us?
I heard about you from Ron Seidel.
Well, Mr. Seidel, he's a good man.
Mm-hmm.
And what is your first name, please?
Cheryl.
Thank you, Miss Cheryl. Appreciate you.
Right now, basically, I am here to listen and learn, okay?
Wonderful. Wonderful. All right, next is Great Falls, Montana, a phone number ending in 9492. How did you hear about us?
Do you hear me?
Hear you just fine.
Okay. This is James in Great Falls.
Okay. I know who you are. I recognize the voice.
Sure. Yeah, we've talked many times.
Wonderful. All right. Thank you, Jim. It's good seeing you again.
Yep.
Okay. All right. So let's leave out some phone numbers here for the first-time callers. 1-800-625-4250. Again, that number is 1-800-625-4250. Now, if you have my direct phone number, it's much preferred that you use that. Either call me, text me, either way. And if you have access to my direct phone number, for instance, Cheryl, you're welcome to ask Ron to give it to you and go ahead and call me if you'd like. So the website, we have a new website that is easier to work with regards to encouraging people to read the little missive titled Once We Were Colonists, Subject to a King, a Primer on Jurisdiction. It's the title of the URL, the domain name is www.onceweworecolonists.com. And when you go there, it's automatically opened up as a PDF, and you can enjoy the good read. You can download it, whatever you like. And then there's also a place to redirect you to American by Birth. So let's start off with the 14th Amendment. That's a good place to start. Prior to the alleged ratification of the 14th Amendment, there was no legal definition of, quote, a citizen of the United States, end quote. As everyone had a primary residence, a primary citizenship in one of the several states. The Constitution referred to the sovereign state citizen and no one else. Those who went to Washington, D.C., or outside the several states, now they were commonly called citizens of the United States. In the Constitution for the United States of America, the term was used to identify state citizens who were eligible under the suffrage laws to hold office, and they were required under the Constitution to have primary allegiance to one of the several states. Interesting thing is that Robert E. Lee was first asked to prosecute the war against the South. His reply was, "Mr. President, I cannot give you an answer until I learn which side of this argument Virginia will fall." So it ended up going to the South, and he ended up leading the military of the South defending against the North. Had Virginia gone to the North, it would have been Robert E. Lee prosecuting the war and not Ulysses Grant. Since the term was not specifically defined in the United States Constitution, Congress in 1868 took advantage of this term and utilized it in the so-called 14th Amendment to describe a new type of citizen whose primary allegiance was to the federal government, that is Washington, D.C., and not to one of the several states of the Union. Thus, using the term as used in the Constitution misled and confused the people as to the true intent and meaning of the Constitution. Many people have mistaken the citizen as denominated in the 14th Amendment to mean the same one in the original Constitution. This is a blatant error. The, quote, citizen of the United States, end quote, as used in the Constitution is not the same as the citizen United States used for the 14th Amendment. So all the elected officials are not sitting in the office constitutionally. They're merely imposters created by the 14th Amendment by law. The current president is a U.S. citizen and therefore not a citizen of the United States defined in the Constitution for the United States of America. Neither the federal senators nor the congressmen are seated constitutionally. In truth, these are facts, and that all federal laws actually are invalid for want of constitutionality. The 14th Amendment creates and defines U.S. citizenship. It has long been contended and has been held by many learned authorities and has never been judicially decided to the contrary, that there was no such thing as a citizen of the United States except first by becoming a citizen of some of the Union states, one of them. Reference U.S. United States versus Anthony, 24 Fed, case number 829, also 830. It's an 1874 decision, right after the Civil War, a decade after it. We have in our political system, this is quoting Cruikshank, 92 U.S. 542, we have in our political system of government of the United States and a government of each of the several states. Each one of these governments is distinct from the others, and each has citizens of its own who owe its allegiance, and whose rights within its jurisdictions it must protect. The same person may be at the same time a citizen of the United States and a citizen of a state, but his rights of citizenship under one of these governments will be different from those he has under the other. In other words, you do not have to be a citizen of the United States in order to be a state citizen. This was to be held true by the Maryland Supreme Court in 1966. Where it's stated in Cross versus Board of Supervisors of Elections, 221, A. 2nd, 431, quote, both before and after the 14th Amendment to the Federal Constitution, it has not been necessary for a person to be a citizen of the United States in order to be a citizen of his state. The federal government was never given any authority to encroach upon the private affairs of the citizens in the several states of the Union, unless they were involved in export or import activity. Neither were they given authority to reach a citizen of Germany living in Germany. It's the same thing. In fact, the state could refuse, if it chose, to enforce any act of Congress that they felt was outside the intent of granting of the limited powers to the federal government. This is called interposition or nullification. Several state Supreme Courts have in the past refused to uphold federal laws within their states. So where does this end us up? A state citizen has the right to have any gun he or she wishes without being registered. A federal citizen does not. In the District of Columbia, it is a felony to own a handgun unless you are a police officer or a security guard or the handgun was registered before 1978. The District of Columbia has never been admitted into the Union, although they are calling for statehood, aren't they? Therefore, the people of the District of Columbia, they are not protected by the Second Amendment or any other part of the Bill of Rights. Despite the lack of legal guns in the District of Columbia, crime is rampant. It's called the murder capital of the world. This should prove that gun control victim disarmament laws do not work in America. Across the country, there is an assault on guns. If you're a federal citizen and you're using your Second Amendment argument to protect your rights to keep a gun, I believe you're going to be in for a surprise. First, by registering gun owners, then renaming guns assault weapons and handguns, those in power will take away your civil rights to bear arms. But not only that, your constitutional rights. It should be your civil privileges to bear arms, let alone your constitutional rights. Of course, they won't tell you that the right to keep and bear arms is a civil right and not a natural right for U.S. citizens. United States Supreme Court has ruled that you, as an individual, have no right to the protection by the police. The police's only obligation is to protect society, not the individual. The real protection for state citizens to keep their guns is not the Second Amendment, but the Ninth Amendment. Notice Switzerland. Every household must have, by law, a fully automatic machine gun and ammunition. Yeah. The crime rate is very low there, by the way. I can imagine why. A state citizen has the right to travel on the public easements. That's your highways and byways. And do so without being registered. A federal citizen does not. It is a privilege for a foreigner to travel in any of our several states. If you are a United States citizen, you are foreign to that union state. The state legislators can require foreigners and people involved in commerce, like chauffeurs and freight haulers, Uber drivers, They can require them to be licensed, insured, to have their vehicles registered. When you register your car, you turn over power of attorney to the state. At that point, it becomes something called a, quote, motor vehicle, end quote. If it's not registered then, it's not a motor vehicle. And there are no motor vehicle statutes to break. There are common laws, common rules for the road. If you don't cause an injury to anyone, you can't be tried. Who's the injured party? There are none in a speeding ticket. If your car is registered, the state effectively owns your car. The state supplies a sticker to put on your license plate every time you re-register that motor vehicle. Look closely at the sticker on your plate right now. You may be surprised to see it says, quote, official use only, end quote. However, some states say, don't use stickers on the plates. You may have seen municipal vehicles that have signs on them saying official use only. But why does yours? You do not own your car. You may have a certificate of title, but you probably don't have a certificate of origin. You're leasing the state's vehicle by paying the yearly registration fee. And because you're using their equipment, they can make the rules up on how it can be used. If you break a rule, such as driving without a seatbelt, you've broken the contract, and an administrative procedure will make you pay a penalty. A state citizen must be able to explain to the police officer why they are not required to have the usual paperwork that most people have. However, your explanations are best saved for court and not for the side of the road. They should carry copies of affidavits and other paperwork in their car. The state citizen should also be prepared to go to traffic court and educate the judge. So these are the things that I wanted to share with you tonight on getting you prepared for our speaker this evening, GW. He's here, and perhaps he'll share with us some updates this week with any of his students and give us a few moments of a monologue. Go ahead, GW.
Hey there. All right. Great introduction there. And it's been an interesting and lively week with a lot of different things happening. But overall, just working with a number of people that are getting their status corrected and trying to understand how to navigate the constitutional waters, so to speak. And I've had some, interesting conversations, and I don't know if I want to bore anybody with too much of the minutiae. There's just what I'm finding is that there is a lot of people right now, and I think I've probably said this a few times, they're waking up. And it's a good thing that people are waking up to the situation and understanding, trying to understand their rights, understand the law, understand jurisdiction. And that's a real good thing. There's just a lot of misguides out there. And so there's just, it's just a constant situation with asking people, what is it you really want to accomplish, and what is your objective? What do you know what you want to accomplish? Do you know what you want to attain through this process or whatever you're doing? If you're just doing it because you think it's a good thing to do, that's not enough of a motivation. It really needs to be some idea. You really need to have some ideals of what you want to accomplish in this process. And so, and I've been working with a couple different providers out there that do very different things than we do, for trying to help people to get remedies. And the simplest foundational thing that you can do is it has to do with changing your mindset and understanding these things that Michael just was explaining in the introduction and with the different Supreme Court cases and that understanding. And there's, some extreme things you can do if you really want to accomplish that. But there's also, if you're just looking to have a kind of a peaceful existence, have a peaceful solution, that is really something that, we're trying to help you do in laying the framework and the groundwork and the foundation, with correcting your status. And then there's other things that you can move into that will help also. And so I don't have, much more to say on that. I imagine hopefully we might have some, I don't know, we might have some new people on the line that would like to get more acquainted with the dynamics of what we're doing here with, you know, correcting people's status and what that really means. So I'm going to turn it over to Martin, or if it's Michael, to open up the call lines, and whoever's there can ask some questions.
Sure. All righty. Press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen. Press star 2. That will cause a response on my end, where it'll put a hand waving your hand next to your name, and then I'll go ahead and call on you. Hey, Miss Tita, hello. Let's unmute you here. Go ahead.
I just wanted to clarify on the new website, because I inputted it and it didn't register. What is name of the website again?
I'm doing this at the same time I'm saying it. www.oncewewerecolonists.com.
Once we were columnists with an F?
Colonists. Like a colony.
Oh, a colony. Colonies. N-I-E-S?
No. All right. I'm going to www.oncewerecolonists.com.
STS.com. All right. Thanks, Michael.
You're welcome. And there it is. Looking at it good. Yep, good and strong. Got rid of the profanity on the cover sheet.
Thank
Anyways,
you.
Yeah, there it is. You're welcome entirely. Also, too, I've, on an aside directly to you, Tita, I talked to the gentleman that assisted me in putting the that particular bank account open, and he's checking with them right now to get the, the statement. So
okay.
We'll have something
Thanks.
To work with between us. Sure.
Appreciate
You're welcome.
All right. Bye-bye.
All righty. Again, press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen, to raise your hand. For those of you on Freedom's Radio, you'll see the silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side at freedomsradio.com, and you just type away your comment or question inside the rectangle. Underneath, you'll see a place to put your name, a few other questions if you'd be so kind to answer, and then hit submit. When you hit submit, it pops up on my end. And I'll be happy to give voice to your comment or your question for GW to respond to. Press star 2. Otherwise, we're going to have a very short call tonight, and that's no fun. We have a good crowd tonight, bigger than normal. All right, so Freedom's Radio. If one were to correct their status and become a citizen of Maryland or Virginia, however, live in a home inside the District of Columbia, they do not have ownership of and carry a firearm, would the District of Columbia have the jurisdiction to prosecute said individual? I know the answer, but let's hear what GW says.
Yeah, really. That is an interesting question. I think it has to do with your mindset, you know, how far they could get with you. And it depends on, do they ask the question, Michael, whether they could be just charged just randomly because they,
no, they live in Virginia or Maryland. That's where they live. They're Virginians or they're
right.
Marylanders.
Right.
But they're, and they have the right to keep and bear arm, but now they're traveling into Washington, D.C. for whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got their firearm with them. Are they subject to anything there?
You know, I would like to see what you say.
Well, you know, when people talk about religious things, I don't say anything. I just quote scripture. I quote the word back to them. And when they talk about the law, you know, what questions like this, I don't offer an opinion. I just quote what the law says about it. So let me find that real quick. It shouldn't take me long.
I'm good.
I'm looking for this one particular case. Just give me a minute. There. No, not there. Stay with me. I'm going to find it. Here we go. All right. Listen to these three court decisions. It's absolutely paramount to understand this. Once you have corrected your status, where the law applies, how the law applies, and to whom the law applies. Houston versus Moore, 18 U.S. 1, 33. This is an 1820 decision. Every citizen of a state owes a double allegiance. He enjoys the protection and participates in the government of both the state and the United States. So what this is telling us is that we can have one foot on the dock and one foot on the boat. It's okay.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a dual citizenship, if you would. Then the next one is 32 years later, 1852. This is Moore versus Illinois, 55 U.S., 13, 20. Quote, every citizen of the United States is also a citizen of a state or a territory. He may be said to owe allegiance to two sovereigns and may, that's the word may, not shall, may be liable to punishment for an infraction of the laws of either. Now, this is where the question is answered. United States versus Cruikshank, 92 U.S., 542, 551. This is 1876, full decade plus after the Civil War. It is the natural consequence of a citizenship which owes allegiance to two sovereignties and claims protection from both. He owes allegiance to the two departments, so to speak. Listen. And within their respective spheres must pay the penalties which each exacts for disobedience to its laws. In return, he can demand protection from each within its own jurisdiction. So, to the Marylander, who is a Union state citizen, who is an American national with constitutional rights, you're free to travel the 50 states of the Union as an American national. When you step on the land described in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, quote, 10 miles within the seat of power, that's Washington, D.C., all territories, possessions, and enclaves, then you have to abide by their rules because you're on their land. No different than if you were to be in New York, a New Yorker, and you travel into Canada. You're subject to Canadian law. Yeah, you may be one of the co-sovereign people of America, but right now you're on somebody else's land, and they can tell you what to do on their land. When you step into Washington, D.C., the territories, possessions, or enclaves, you're on land owned by the Congress, the government. All right? Now, are you a franchise and a property of the United States then? No, you are not. Only a United States citizen is a franchise and property of the United States, but you're in their house. We don't have smoking in our house, in my home. There's no smoking. If you're a smoker and you come in, you're not allowed to light up in my home. Furthermore, my wife, seeing people spit on the sidewalk and you're walking around in your shoes, when you come into my home, we have slippers for you. There's a place to take off your shoes, like a mudroom, and you can put on the slippers and walk around the house. Weird? Yeah, maybe, to some. But it's our house. It's our rules. Under my roof. You know, you understand that language. You probably, when you were a teenager or before, your daddy said to you, "Not well, you're not wearing that mini skirt while you're under my roof." Well, that's okay, Daddy. I'll just change outside. Anyways, point being is when you step into the United States, that's all territories, possessions, and enclaves. You have to go by the rules. That's all there is to it. But as long as you're operating in the Union states, you don't. Now, have they committed, done something legally to defraud you in extending the United States? Absolutely they have. You know they have. In fact, when we go to something called the Buck Act, let me go to there real quick. Here it is. Let me see what I can find here real quick. This is too lengthy a story to cover, but basically there is a map of the United States of America that includes the 50 sovereign and independent states which are freely associated together in the Union. It does not include the District of Columbia, which was created by the Constitution of the Union as the legal home for the federal government. The federal government was intended to be a servant to the Union states and not their master. In order for the federal government to act against the citizen of one of the several states, they had to create a contractual nexus. This contractual nexus is called Social Security. And to that end, you possess a Social Security number. The federal government always does everything according to the principles of law. No exceptions. In 1935, the federal government instituted Social Security. The Social Security Board then created 10 Social Security districts, creating federal areas which covered the several states like an outlay, an overlay. In 1939, the federal government instituted the Public Salary Act of 1939, which is a municipal law of the District of Columbia taxing all federal and state government employees and those who live and work in any federal area. Now, the government knows it cannot tax those citizens who live and work outside the territorial jurisdiction of Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, or Article 4, Section 3, Clause 2. So, in 1940, Congress passed the Buck Act. You'll find it at 4 USCS 104 through 113, and particularly Section 110E, as in Edward. This act allowed any department of the federal government to create a federal area for the imposition of the Public Salary Act of 1939. The imposition of this tax and the rest of the taxing law is also found in Title 26, the Internal Revenue Code. The Social Security Board had already created an overlay of federal areas. And as a result, the federal government created federal states, which are exactly like the sovereign Union states, occupying the same geographical venue, on the same territory of land and the same boundaries, but whose names are capitalized versions of the sovereign states. Remember, in the old days, if you're old enough on this call to remember the proper names and the proper pronouns for each of the states, for instance, Illinois, is overlaid over the state of Illinois and so forth. We'd abbreviate Florida with FLA, period, an uppercase F, a lowercase LA. And when you have the state of Florida, it's uppercase F, uppercase L. For California, you used to have upper and lowercase CALIF, period. Now you have capital C, capital A. For California. And that's because CALIF, California, is a union state with constitutional rights and immunities, the people, versus CA, all uppercase, is a federal territory of the United States. You see the overlay? So, how do you deal with this? you always demand jurisdiction, you always challenge jurisdiction, and you do not get off that point until the prosecutor with the judge enter that into the record as evidence, the land jurisdiction you're operating on and the personam jurisdiction of who the defendant in error is. You don't get off of it. Let me see if I can find these. Here we go, the remedies. When you're in front of a judge, I'd be filing these papers. The United States Supreme Court, this is Shore versus Rhodes, 416 U.S. 232. It's a 1974 decision, 1974. It's not that long ago. Quote, U.S. Supreme Court held that state officials acting by, quote, color of law, end quote, may be held personally liable for the injuries or torts they cause, and that official or sovereign immunity, judicial immunity, whatever they want to call it, may not be asserted, end quote. I embellished. I went off script there. It says, and that official or sovereign immunity may not be asserted, is the actual verbiage. And then Warnock versus Pecos County, Texas, 116 F, 3rd, 776. This is a 1997 decision. Quote, when a state officer acts under a state law in a manner violative of the federal constitution, he comes into conflict with the superior authority of that constitution, and he is, in that case, stripped of his official or representative character and is subjected to his personal, to his person, to the consequences of his individual conduct. The state has no power to impart to him any immunity from responsibility to the supreme authority of the United States, end quote. So you see, for myself, I've been told I'm belligerent. I am. That's how I've solved problems all my life, from the playground to wherever. And when a reputation precedes you, people tend to leave you alone when it comes to wanting to take your lunch money. This is called deprivation of rights under color of law. So something I might say in a court after I had shared this with them is, Your Honor, permission to approach front of the court. Would it please this honorable court to be made aware of something that could have negative repercussions of a substantial nature upon either the court or the bench? That's what I'd be saying to them. And I learned that from John, who, by the way, everyone, you should be on tomorrow night's call. Hopefully he'll be well enough to chat with us. He's got a tremendous workload, and he's not feeling well, so he may again pass tomorrow night. We don't know, but we'll find out. I'll find out maybe 5 minutes before the call, see if I'm doing the call. Point being to all of this, to answer that question, when you go into the District of Columbia, you're playing by their house rules. It's as simple as that. When you're in any of the other states, you are under constitutional protections. And the things that I just shared with you in the last 10 minutes are what I would be doing where I similarly situated to you, having come into trouble with whether it's traffic or it doesn't matter what it is. They could find a half a pound of cocaine or 10 pounds of cocaine in the trunk of your car. Doesn't matter. Where in the Constitution says that you can't do cocaine? It doesn't. The point of truth, in fact, 125 years ago, medical doctors, the American Medical Association, was prescribing cocaine to help you get through the day. What was the ingredient in Coca-Cola when it first came out? All right, so yeah. You know, we just come back to the reality of if you know who you are, if you know what land you're sojourning across, you'll be fine. And when you learn this, internalize this, and again, once we were colonists, subject to a king, I have it printed out, and I'm still reading it. I keep it in the bathroom. And when I want to get distracted, I start reading it again. to the point where I can almost memorize the thing. All right, so I hope I answered that question. GW, have any follow-up on that?
I think that was excellent. You know, I really like how you put that together. You know, that's
I just read it off of Once We Were Calling a Subject to a King.
Yeah, there you go.
All right. Ed, Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania. Go ahead, buddy.
Hey, guys. Fitting all of what you just said, how does, I guess it depends on, what's the word I want, hermeneutic of how you want to read the Constitution, whether all the clauses are standalone clauses, or whether they follow upon one another, further explaining one another, et cetera, et cetera. Going along with what you just read to us, Article 4, Section 3, second paragraph, says the Congress shall have power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States. And nothing in this Constitution shall be so construed as to prejudice any claims of the United States or of any particular state. Then Section 4 says, the United States shall guarantee to every state of this Union a republican form of government and shall protect each of them against invasion and on application of the legislature or of the executive, when the legislature cannot be convened, against domestic violence. And I think, my own opinion, and opinion of a bunch of other people too, is the United States has violated its own, the fact that it's the guarantee of a republican form of government in each state of the Union, and has instead invaded each state of the Union with the municipal government of Washington, D.C.
And we, the people, allowed it.
Well, yeah, people allowed it, but it came first. They made the changes first, and then people allowed it.
From 1935 to 1940, referring back to the Buck Act and the Social Security and all that stuff right there, 1933 forward, we allowed it to happen. We were ignorant. We didn't understand its ramifications, how it spidied out into all the different places of the Union. And we gladly accepted it.
Yep, planned by people wanting a financial tyranny.
Yep.
Next question there is, since you got the Buck Act open, is it in there that U.S. citizens can be taxed on property they hold in the states, and that is sort of the basis for income tax or property taxation on property held by people, because they're U.S. citizens, in every municipality of the United States, except there's a few states, I think maybe two states, that don't tax property.
All right, you use the word municipality.
Yeah.
The root to the word municipality is muni, as in ammunition, as
okay.
in military.
Yeah.
Municipalities are the federal government, not the state, not the union state. So can they tax the land? Not legally.
No, that's what
tax,
I think,
they
too.
Can tax territorial. They can tax territorial land, but they can't tax union state land, not the federals.
Right.
And the state government in the state constitution has to have
property.
It in the state constitution, and I don't believe it is in any state constitution, the right to tax.
Nope. No, they on the right sections of each state constitution, they protect the exercise of your property rights. And yet
you want to know what chains of law you're bound to as a union state citizen? read your Constitution, and then read the session laws, S-E-S-S-I-O-N,
yep.
The session laws of your state. That's what you're bound to. That's it. Remember, the Constitution for your state was authored by and we the people of that state.
Understood.
And as the creators, the people of that state are always greater than the state. So what they put in there is a contract that they all agree to operate through and their progeny forever until they amend it.
I'll have to see if I can't get a hold of this somewhere.
Good luck. Anyone else? Press star 2 on your keypad. Any other questions, Ed?
No, I heard you say good luck. You're right. Luck doesn't exist.
All right, let me check Freedom's Radio real quick. Nobody else has written in. That was a good question, whoever wrote it in. I appreciate that question. It gave us a good springboard to go into it. Next is Brother Kent. I swear I'm going to make this guy an information provider. He is so full of information.
Okay. Can you hear me all right, gentlemen?
Yeah, Kent.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, thank you. So, Mike, I wanted to clarify a couple things you were saying in the cases you were quoting. So if we were going into a post office inside a du jour organic state, on land that is within the state, or we were going into a courthouse, not one that's leased, but one where the government or the purported government actually claims they own the land, I would conclude from the cases, including Cruikshank that you read, you would put those areas within the organic state in the same category as you would D.C. or not?
Greg, was it you that told a story about the law professor that staged a fight in a post office?
Was it me?
Yeah.
Law professor that staged a fight in a post office? No. And that wasn't
okay.
Me.
Then it was either PJ or John. All right. I'm going to parrot a story as best I can remember. It'll keep it short.
Okay.
I'm sorry?
No, I said, okay.
All right. A law professor teaching law, right, wanted to demonstrate to his students the power of jurisdiction. So he went into a post office and did something that caused a controversy at the federal level. I don't know what it was. I don't remember. I was told what it was, but I just don't remember. But it had something to do with the United States Post Office, Post Service, and it was federal. So the Sheriff's Department was across the street. He knew this. He knew the post office he went to. So the Sheriff's deputies came over, arrested him, ROR'd him, released on his own recognizance. And when he went into court, the judge was asking, how do you plead? Federal court. And at that point there, he basically covered some of the things that we covered on tonight's call. He was able to articulate it much better than I. And the judge discharged the case against him because that post office was not federal land. He brought a map into the courtroom and said, "This is a county map showing county property. And if you notice, there is no federal property here in this particular county. There are no forts or other types of buildings that required a federal presence. Now, if you were in Charleston, you have federal property there because there's forts and magazines and so forth that were there in the Civil War. They may have been ceded back to the state. I don't know, but at one time, South Carolina ceded to the federal government that land for forts and munitions and so forth. And the court had no opportunity, no other recourse than to drop the charges. When you come on tomorrow night's call, John will be sharing with you that he received this week maps from Mr. T's family of the county land maps, showing what belonged to the county, what was public, and what was private land in that county. None of it's federal.
So let me clear up something that you're saying.
And Mr. T's charges are federal. The city dropped their charges. Mr. T's charges are federal. Go ahead.
Okay. So what you're saying is because this law professor, in accomplishing the wanting to show the students what the jurisdiction issue is about, that mm-hmm. because he created a federal level controversy, but because mm-hmm. the sheriff's department, which resides in the county, came on the scene and arrested him, et cetera, ROR'd him, there was no jurisdiction because he had created a federal level controversy, not a controversy over which the sheriff's department or the local police department would have jurisdiction.
It went further than that. It was in federal court. In other words, for that court to do anything other than dismiss the case, they would have to have confessed on the record the importance and power of land jurisdiction, establishing which it is. So they would rather, it's like the IRS. When you box the IRS in the corner by their own rules, by the law, when it goes to a place where there's going to be a judgment against the IRS, they'll drop all the charges. They will write letters that say, not only do you not have an obligation to pay an income tax, neither your progeny will not have an obligation to pay their income tax, pay the income tax. Because they would rather lose that way, where it's not published on the record, than to have it published against them on the record.
Okay, so where do you rely on?
They rely on court cases to muscle their way through.
Right. So land jurisdiction, you're actually saying territorial jurisdiction when you say land jurisdiction.
Well, it depends. When we say territorial, we're saying United States. We're saying Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17.
Okay, so that could be land jurisdiction or it may not be land jurisdiction dependent.
Yeah, which land is this? Does this land belong to one of the several Union states by and under the Constitution, or does it belong to the United States?
Okay, but I was trying to separate, for the sake of brevity, I was trying to separate the jurisdictions. So when we talk about in personam or rem the thing versus subject matter jurisdiction versus territorial jurisdiction, I think when we say land jurisdiction, we're basically talking about territorial.
It's called territorium. You have personam, which is the person or the body, and you have territorium, which is the land. Does the territory belong to the United States or is it land of the Union state?
Okay, all right. That answers my question. That was the line along which I was thinking. Now, what you were saying about, to go on to the second part of this, what you were saying about the fact that cases, Houston versus Moore, Cruikshank, et cetera, indicate that when you're in their territory, which we were talking about D.C., then you have to follow their rules. So even as an organic de jure state inhabitant of Maryland or Virginia, to use your example, you would still not be able to carry a gun in D.C. But where do we draw the line when, in fact, you openly admit that they perpetrated a fraud on us, and we do have the right to petition our government, and while we might say that the only people really sitting behind desks with lights on in D.C. are those in the federal government or the fictional Wogoway or the de facto, we could argue that the republic still exists because without the republic, there could be no Wogoway. And we've discussed this before on these calls. So keeping that in mind, why wouldn't one be able to go to D.C. to petition their government, the republic, actually, and use this example that we were talking about tonight and the question, well, Freedom's Radio, carry a gun? I just throw that out there for discussion.
I'm sorry, I heard you, but I don't understand your question.
Okay. If we have
Virginia is a union state. The state of Virginia is a territory of the United States.
I understand.
The assumption is always that you're on the land of the United States, no matter what state you're in. And we break that presumption.
So once we've broken that presumption and we have a right to petition our government, the republic, then we would have a right as a Virginian or a Marylander or from any of the other 48 states, we would have a right to physically go there and petition our government. Well, if we physically go there and petition the government, why, even under Cruikshank, why would we have to follow? Now, I'm not talking about this just pragmatically. I'm talking about this from a point of view of law. Why wouldn't we be able to go there with a gun, not to use it, but while we were petitioning our government in the republic, which happens to be in D.C.?
Because their house rules say you can't. So petition your government through your local representative with his office in Maryland or New Jersey or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking for, I want to give credit where it's due here. Michael from Las Wages, Nevada, shared with me a book called, and I bought two of them. I'm sharing one with John. It's called An Introduction to Constitutional Law 100. And I'm looking here, looking for where it says that I'm looking where it says the reason for Title 42. Michael, let me unmute you. Michael, do you remember where that was, where it talked about that the purpose of Title 42, 1983, was that any state citizen may use that to enforce their rights? Do you remember? I've unmuted you, Michael. I don't see it. He sent it to me, but I don't see it. Anyways, basically what it says is a Supreme Court justice or somebody up there in the high cotton clearly just came out and said that Title 42, Section 1983, 5 and 6 are the tools that a union state citizen, American national, has to deal with misbehaving judges, misbehaving public servants. You know anything about that, GW?
No. I mean, you've addressed it before. Not in that way. But you've talked about Title 42 and specifically that 18, what is it again? The section?
Title 42, section 85 and 86.
Yeah. I've heard you bring it up several times, but never identifying that, you know, this little caveat that this is the way to deal with rogue judges.
Yeah. Spank them.
Interesting.
Can I continue?
Yeah, go ahead. While you're doing that, I'm going to look for this.
All right, so I want to make one other comment. I had an interesting experience towards the end of last week. I went to a memory council meeting to assist someone else that has a problem in a certain municipality. And when I got up and made the presentation, I identified the name and address. I spelled out the name, upper and lowercase, et cetera. And then I gave latitude and longitude, and then I gave them their physical street address in their parlance. And I made some other comments about my presentation was to a service corporation. It wasn't to the du jour organic republic form of government that we were promised, et cetera, et cetera. They then had two other people speak in the public session, and one gentleman was there to complain about what he believed were some improper conduct on the part of the police department. And apparently some of the people in the town knew this gentleman already and some of the problems he was having. After the public session, the mayor commented, and then the city attorney said that he wanted to make a comment. Interesting enough, nobody addressed. The mayor just smiled while I talked because I've had some other conversations with him, and he understands what I'm talking about to a certain extent. I don't think, you know, the understanding that the people on this call have, but he does understand some of this. I think all the other people have this glazed over look on their face. But interestingly enough, when the attorney asked the mayor to speak, because that's the conduct how it goes in a mayor council meeting in that state, when he asked to speak and they let him speak, he only addressed the gentleman that had the issue with the police department. He said nothing about any of the comments I made, but he went into some detail about how we live in a democracy and that this gentleman was lucky that he had the right to come down there and air his grievances against the police department before the city council. What I thought was
objection, sir. Why do you spread your ignorance amongst the people? Democracy is only within Washington, D.C. You're here in West Virginia, one of the union states. We have a guaranteed Republican form of government, sir. Are you ignorant of the law?
Yeah, that would have been great if you were there.
While they had closed the public session and they stopped the other gentleman from speaking because he wanted to say something else and they stopped him, there's nothing to preclude me from going back and making the issue that has to be made out of that statement and putting that on the record the next time. So
there you go. There you go.
I found what I was looking for,
Kent.
Okay.
This is Frankenhauser versus Rizzo, 59 FRD. It's a 1973 decision. Quote, it is the manner of enforcement which gives Title 42, 1983, the unique importance, for enforcement is placed in the hands of the people. Each citizen acts as a private attorney general who takes on the mantle of the sovereign, guarding for all of us the individual liberties enunciated in the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
Boom. Boom.
Well, isn't that part of, I don't know Rod Klass's whole case, but wasn't that part of what Rod Klass was trying to accomplish with his gun case in D.C. and acting as a private AG?
I know that that was part of what he was doing. I don't know really anything about it. I've spoken to Mr. Klass a couple of times. He's way, way, way busy. And I actually tried to get him on a call. I tried to bring him into the fold as an information provider. This is many years ago, but he was just flat out too busy. That's understandable. He's got his own thing going, and he's overwhelmed with it, as we're overwhelmed here.
Has anybody that you know of, Mike or Greg or anybody else on the call for that matter, has anybody which has been talked about briefly before, obtaining the oaths of office of these individuals, then written back to them and asked and told them that thank you for your oath, but I see that you swore your oath to a private for-profit corporation, not to the Republic. And since that's the oath you swore, I don't know, there could be a number of questions after that. Where's your foreign registration? You're acting as a foreign agent, et cetera. Do you know anybody that's carried it forth to that point?
John has.
John has? Okay.
I believe so.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe mistaken.
Okay. That's about all I have. Thank you very much for your
all
time.
Right. Thank you so much. I want to, before I go for GW's closing remarks, there's something else that I came across I want to share with people just so they firmly understand the power of the Second Amendment. Oh, there's Michael. There he is. Hey, buddy.
Go ahead with what you were saying, then I'll make a comment.
Okay. You know, the whole world and our own politicians seem to be against us because of our claims for gun rights and things like that. The United States is third in murders throughout the world. Third. However, Chicago, Detroit, Washington, D.C., St. Louis, New Orleans. If you remove those five Democrat-controlled for half a century or more, decades and decades, if you look at their gun laws, which are the strictest of gun laws in all the nations, if you just remove those five cities from the equation, the United States then becomes the 189th out of the 193 countries in the world as being the most dangerous for murders and so forth. So what it shows us is that the communists, otherwise known as the Democrat Party, here in the United States, or they like to call themselves socialists or progressives to tame the word communist, but they are communists. If you remove them from the equation, those five major cities, the gun rights have made us a most peaceable society. In fact, somebody once said, a well-armed society is a polite society. Yeah. You notice they don't pull this crap here in Florida or other states that have, you know, good gun laws, if you would, even as far as it's concerned with United States citizens. For instance, Florida recently passed, and it will be effective in five more days, the right to carry concealed without a permit. They call it constitutional carry law. The humor behind it, for me anyways, is that we all have always had this constitutional carry for Union states, for Floridians. But now the state of Florida citizens, they have the right too, but it's actually a privilege because it was granted by the government. So it can be taken away by the government. But a Union state citizen, a Floridian, that right comes from the creator of the universe. And no one but the creator of the universe can rescind it.
Amen.
Done. Well, Mr. Michael?
I don't know why you need a permit to carry a gun. I've never had a permit.
The truth of the matter is, I have carried a J-frame Smith & Wesson since I was a senior in high school, carrying it to school. Nobody ever knew it. And twice in my life, I had to expose it on my hip, pull back my jacket, and de-escalated the situation very quickly. And once I had to pull it and cock the hammer and aim it at someone, saying, don't do that. I'll sleep well tonight knowing that I'm sleeping well tonight and you're dead. Don't do that. And they didn't. Police came. I handed my weapon over, told them what went on, got it back a couple of months later. That weapon, anyways. The right to keep and bear arms will not be infringed. Anything else, Michael? We got Charlie with one other question here. Go ahead.
Well, the what you call that? foreign agent registration form. They're supposed to have a current foreign agent registration form.
They have.
And every government official, every cop, every judge, every prosecutor, they're supposed to have their current foreign agent. They're foreign agents. They're in violation of the Trading with the Enemies Act.
Do you have a workup on that? You'd like to share with me?
I don't. I'm driving right now. I've got the books at the house somewhere. But
I'm buying every book you've referred me to.
anyway, it's I got a friend of mine in California. His daughter's in Kansas. They arrested her because her brother came over to her house and drank a beer, and they're trying to take her child away. And they've got her in jail. She hasn't been to trial, but they've got her in jail locked up. And I'm trying to tell him, you know, you need to listen in on the call and you need to do this and you need to instruct her on what to say and object to everything. If you don't object, you can't appeal.
Right.
And then bring up the fact that they're a corporation. Where am I a member of your corporation and how did I become a member of your corporation? What jurisdiction do you have? But unless I can get him to do that, I mean, I don't see no positive outcome for her. She's going to lose her daughter to the same woman that he lost his daughter, hers, to, that lives off of the system by the system paying her to take care of somebody's child.
Yeah.
It's a corrupt system there in Kansas.
Yeah. While you're bringing this up about family law, that's what you're talking about, I do have an agreement with a gentleman from New Jersey that's coming aboard as an information provider specifically and uniquely on family law.
Yeah.
40 years. 40 years experience.
That seems to me who Larry needs to be talking to then.
All right. Anything else, Michael? We're going to go with Charlie and then be done with the night.
Go ahead. Thank you.
All right, Charlie, what's up?
Yeah, great question. I'm sure there's lots of great stats, you know, regarding, you know, your murder rate and all that. And the one you quoted is probably, if you have a reference to that, I might email you for it. Do I bother? Do you have a reference to that?
That's just a meme that I quoted from, and there was an earlier meme maybe 2 years ago that actually gave me the stats from the federal government. So one of the agencies of the federal government generated the report.
I just heard it on a major, and I can't tell you what it was. I can't tell you who it was right now because they monitor so much stuff, but it was on a major platform. It said the exact same thing as Michael said. It said our country rates up with like the, what was it, Michael? It was like the sixth, deadliest place. I mean, for homicides and whatnot. And then if you take out those totally Democrat blue run, you know, Marxist states that have the most hideous gun laws, you take them out, we drop way back to 180 something. I just remember that.
189 out of 192.
Yeah.
Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
Well, thanks for sharing that. It'd be nice to have the reference, but that's good.
Just start using your search engine for those parameters.
I'll take a look. Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
GW, any closing comments, GW?
Yeah, I just have a couple here. I'm a little somber this week. It's been a little, for the past few days, was a little emotional, a little turbulent with one situation. It was a friend of mine who I've known for, almost 40 years. And we met each other going after I was in my 20s, going after a couple Mormon missionaries, and we basically double teamed them. And I met him, you know, because he was going after him, I was going after him at the same time, and we met, and he did a lot of street preaching, and we became pretty good friends. But over the years, we kind of grew apart, then we kind of reconnected, and then after the pandemic, he really, his whole demeanor changed, and towards, which is kind of crazy, towards Trump, you know, trying to blame Trump on all the crap that's going on and the vaccinations and everything else. And I used to go over there for dinner and with some friends and his wife, and he was just so angry. He was just angry. And anyway, he was angry at God. He passed away on Saturday. And right before he passed away, he was taking a nap, and his wife went back in to check on him, and he was blue. He's gone. He had had a heart attack about 10 days before that, and I was showing a kind of a vision. I was praying about it, and I reached out to his wife, and it's just, you know, he had so much unforgiveness towards other people and towards God, and it's like, you know, I just want to say, I mean, I pleaded with him, you know, to get right, because God says in his word, he says that, you know, that's part of the Lord's Prayer. It says, you know, part of the Lord's Prayer says, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive others their trespasses. And there's other scripture that says, you know, how can you be forgiven if you don't forgive? I mean, how can you be forgiven? And it indicates that, you know, you don't want to hold that stuff back, because it really gives the enemy an open door. So anyway, I've been thinking a lot about that, and I'm just a little bit somber this week. So that's my statement, and, you know, kind of closing. So
Michael,
there you go.
Yeah. Yeah. One is tomorrow night, 9:00 okay. Eastern. Prayerfully, John will be with us. We'll have an update as the stomach churns, which is giving a week-by-week blow of what's going on with Mr. T. And you have this rare opportunity in this week-by-week viewing of as the stomach turns to see how litigation falls plays out, and the power of standing in law as an American national. Until then, good night, everyone, and be well.
Good night.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you.